Well, howdy there, stranger. I'm Jordy.
And I'm Brad.
And welcome back to Beers with Queers, the true crime podcast where I research a case, and Brad here, and potentially you guys,
don't know a damn thing about it.
So for today's case, we're actually going to reel it back in a little bit closer to home, and we're taking you guys on a trip to Gatlinburg, Tennessee. So I'm sure a lot of you, if you're American, are familiar with the Gatlinburg and Pigeon Forge area of Tennessee.
I mean, that's where Dollywood's at.
Exactly. That's where Dollywood's at. That's where Dolly Parton herself is from, like the greatest human being to ever exist.
And if you're in Tennessee and you're going to go visit Gatlinburg with, say, a girlfriend or a boyfriend, that means you're Gatlinburg official, and that means you're probably going to go get married.
That is true. So that's actually where my mother got married, is Pigeon Forge. So it holds a lot of memories. And fun fact, Gatlinburg is actually the number one tourist destination in the United States and the fifth most popular destination in the world. So to think this little small town that has all these just like random weird sideshow attractions is that popular in the world, number five in the world.
Yeah, if you don't know about Gatlinburg, look it up. It's redneck Las Vegas.
And the funny thing is that despite all these tourists, and I'll talk about redneck Las Vegas here in a minute because that is the only way to summarize Gatlinburg.
In a good way. I mean that in a very good way. It's redneck Las Vegas. You can kind of do whatever you want to with a country southern flair.
Yeah, so it's very fun. I love Gatlinburg. But surprising with all the tourists, it only has a population of about 6,000 people. So it's honestly really freaking small. But it sees an annual 14 million tourists year-round on average. So a lot of people take their vacations for the area, and it's understandable why. Because, you know, like I said, it's funny. I always mention to my friends how when I grew up in West Virginia, because that's where I'm originally from, Gatlinburg was the one place we went every year, and it was just so magical. It seemed so magical to me. It was like my Disney World, because, you know, we couldn't afford Disney World when I was growing up, so we went to Gatlinburg. And now it's just so funny that it's only like a 40-minute drive from my house, and I go up there every other weekend, honestly, if I want to. So even though we visited a lot, it still hasn't lost much of its charm. Still got a lot of weird stuff to do. Still got Dollywood. And it's still a pretty hopping place year-round. And for those outside of the United States, the best way to describe Gatlinburg, like Brad said, was it is redneck Las Vegas. Or I even saw a meme once that said Gatlinburg is just Las Vegas for Baptists. And 100% that is completely accurate.
I'm going to jump in real quick and say I was over in England once, and I stopped at a little pub in a town called Whitstable, which was ran by two very nice lesbians. When they asked me what I'd like to drink, soon as they heard me speak, they were like, "Where are you from?" And I said, "Tennessee." And they said, "Oh, Dollywood and Jack Daniels. That's the number one thing you hear when you visit from outside of the country and you're from Tennessee." And then they said, "Have you ever heard of a place called Sevierville?" Which is where Gatlinburg is at. And I was like, "Oh yeah, I've heard of it." And they said, "It's the best place we've ever visited in the United States." So that blew my mind, actually, because I live so close to it, I guess I don't appreciate it like I should.
And that's what I was saying too. Like when I was growing up in West Virginia, like it was like a big deal. Like every year we looked forward to the Gatlinburg trip. And yeah, that's the perfect way to describe it. On the outside, I think a lot of people, if you haven't been, it does look like just one giant tourist trap. And it can be, if you don't know where to look or have like a tour guide with you or someone that knows all the special cool places. But it really does have that good old Appalachian charm to it. And I think everyone, if given the chance, should visit it because I love it. So like I said, it's a very touristy town, and that is its main source of revenue for the surrounding area, and it pulls in an estimated $2 billion annually. So there's all kinds of novelty shops, tourist attractions, such as the Wax Museum. There's the Titanic Museum.
There's a true crime museum.
There is a true crime museum, the Alcatraz Crime Museum. Highly recommend it. It has all kinds of fascinating, like, real-life evidence. It has, like, Ted Bundy's Beetle that he actually used during the murders. It has
O.J.'s white Bronco.
O.J. Simpson's white Bronco. And all kinds of, like, pieces of evidence and artifacts from true crime cases from the last, like, 200 years. We've been, like, four times. I kind of want to go back. And honestly, we might have to plan a Gatlinburg trip after this. But, of course, it also has Dollywood, which Dollywood alone brings in an estimated 60,000 guests daily. And all kinds of other things to do with the family. They even have a ski lodge in the winter. And it's also the entryway, of course, into the Great Smoky Mountains, which is the most visited national park in the United States. So that helps drive up traffic through the area. And we're both very avid hikers, and so we go through the area quite a lot throughout the year. So perfect area for us. We can go to Dollywood or we can go hiking. So it has something for all of you, depending on what your interest is. Now, of course, when you have that many people passing through the area on any given day, you gotta have a crap ton of places for them to stay. So hotels and motels are endless all around the area to house millions of tourists, one of the most popular of which used to be the Rocky Top Village Inn, all the way up through the 1980s until a horrific act of violence that left two people dead and the city terrified. So today we are traveling back to 1980s Gatlinburg to talk about the Gatlinburg Motel murders. So now that we've spent the first, almost 10 minutes as a big advertisement for Gatlinburg, we are going to get a little serious here and talk about one of the darker sides of the area. So on September 16th, 1986, in Maggie Valley, North Carolina, a phone booth sits right outside the Good Old Boys restaurant and just a stone's throw away from a police station. Inside the phone booth is an envelope, and with it, it reads, "To the police," scribbled on the front of it. Now, upon opening the letter, authorities are greeted with a small pocket knife and an unsigned confession that read, "Please forgive me for killing those two people up in Gatlinburg. I was just wanting the money and was going to leave them handcuffed in the room, but the guard tried to reach for the gun and Joe saw him. He hit him with a flashlight and then went crazy. He cut them up badly and then ordered me to shoot them. I hope they were already dead. I hoped I missed the girl. She was really nice. He made me shoot the guard between the eyes. Sorry about all of this, but Joe is mean. He would have killed me too if I didn't do as he said. I hope they had no kids. I can't sleep thinking about it. I am so sorry it happened. Please forgive me. I hope I can start sleeping. If not, I'm going to kill myself. I'm going home. Hope I can get away from Joe. He's mean. He'll kill me if he finds out that I wrote this letter. I just asked for forgiveness. Here's the girl's knife. I hope it means something to someone. Please forgive me."
Well, that's an interesting start right there.
Yeah, so that is weird to find on its own. And of course, you may be thinking, of course, it could potentially be like a prank, a little letter, or someone just messing with people. People have a really morbid sense of humor. But police are about to find out that this letter writer was very serious and that he was connected to the actual crime. Now, the writer was long gone, and they left no clear indicator of his or her identity in the letter. However, investigators quickly discovered that this strange note was another piece of puzzle connecting to a shocking double homicide that occurred in Tennessee over 100 miles away from Maggie Valley, just 3 days prior on September 13th. Now, the pocket knife that was discovered along with the note was actually found to belong to one of the victims, 21-year-old Melissa Hill, and investigators were excited that they finally had a piece of evidence and a starting point to help them with their investigation. The evidence was sent back to where the murders occurred and given to investigators in Gatlinburg, Tennessee, whom had been left puzzled as to why such a brutal and seemingly random act of violence had occurred in their town. The killers left no clues or physical evidence behind and had disappeared into the night, leaving the city of Gatlinburg and over 1 million tourists in fear of when they would strike next. Now, Gatlinburg is always a busy and loud place to be. There's always things to do, lights flashing and people everywhere taking in all the excitement, but it was on the night of September 13th, 1986, that the facade of happiness and fun was shattered with a gruesome discovery that to this day haunts the locals who live there. So like I said earlier, with this many tourists coming and going every day of the year, there has to be a place to fit them all. So of course, you'll find no shortage of hotels and motels in the area, and one of the most popular ones was the Rocky Top Inn, located off of historic Nature Drive in the heart of Gatlinburg. The motel was opened in 1979 by famous songwriting duo Felice and Bedello Bryant, I hope I pronounced his name right, whom have produced and written some of the most iconic and hit songs for artists such as Buddy Holly, Conway Twitty, and probably most famous of all, they're the ones who actually wrote our state's unofficial anthem, Rocky Top, in 1967. So, also, if you don't know what Rocky Top is, pause this episode real quick and pull it up on Spotify or wherever you're listening to it, because it is a song all Tennesseans know by heart.
And don't judge us too harshly.
No, please, don't judge us. Now, the inn was an instant success, of course, and enjoyed hundreds of guests a week. On the night of September 13th, only two employees were working the late shift at the inn, the motel night manager, Robert Bennett, and 21-year-old desk clerk, Melissa Hall. So the motel was pretty big and actually had two separate offices. The main office was located up the street on Airport Drive Road, and then the secondary office located at the actual inn. Robert was working at the main office while Melissa was counting receipts for the day at the secondary office. And up to that point, everything was going about business as normal. And Robert last heard from Melissa when he phoned her at 8 p.m. to just, you know, check on her, see if she needed anything. And she assured him that everything was going great. So Melissa was scheduled to end her shift at 11 p.m. So Robert phoned her again at 10 to go over anything else that maybe needed to do after she left. However, this time he received no answer. He waited a bit more before attempting to call her two more times at 10:45 and again received no answer. Now worried that something may be really wrong, Robert spotted the motel security guard, 36-year-old Troy Valentine, pulling into the parking lot ready to begin his shift. So Robert asked Troy to head over to the main inn to check on Melissa and to call him when he gets there to make sure everything's okay. Troy left and drove the less than 5-minute drive to the main office, so honestly it should have taken 10 minutes tops, find Melissa, see that she's okay, and then phone Robert. So Robert waited patiently by the phone, however Troy never called back, and almost after an hour of not hearing back from either Troy or Melissa, Robert decided to drive over to the motel himself and check it out. Now upon arriving, he instantly knew that something was wrong, as the entire motel was dead silent, and it looked abandoned. Which, of course, is something you never see in Gatlinburg. He checked the office where Melissa was working, but found that she was not there. Looking around the deserted parking lot, Robert noticed that the curtains in room 1 directly by the back office were partially open. Getting a feeling that something weird was going on, he walked over and decided to peek inside. Looking inside, it was there on the floor of the 2-bed motel room that he saw Troy Valentine on the floor, lying in a massive pool of blood. And that's when he quickly went to call the police. So police dispatch received the call just a little before midnight, and it went out all across the city and the neighboring town of Sevierville. One of the first to hear the call and to pass it on to officers in the area was a man named Doug Hill, a police dispatcher and Melissa Hill's husband. Now, Doug and Melissa were actually high school sweethearts and married shortly after graduating. The two were very much in love and set out about making a life for themselves in Gatlinburg, with dreams of one day starting a family. Since both of them worked the late shift at their job, the two would often call each other and talk throughout the night, you know, just to spend some sort of time with each other. Doug described Melissa as being extremely outgoing and friendly, and one of her favorite parts of her job working at the motel was being able to tell tourists all the best spots to visit and places to eat, and she enjoyed just meeting new people. Doug last heard from Melissa that night at around 10:30 p.m., so after the last time Robert heard from her. According to him, she was on the phone with him, still counting the receipts from the day, and made no indication that anything was wrong. He called her again right before at 11 p.m. to see about picking up food to take home after they both got off. However, this time he received no answer. So at first he wasn't too worried and figured that she must have gotten held up with something. That is until the 911 call came over his radio about a body being found at the motel. The call went out as being for a man down at the Rocky Top Village Inn without any mention of a woman being found. Doug immediately began trying to call Melissa at the office but found all of his calls going unanswered. As Doug began to panic, he was contacted by his manager and informed that he needed to get down to the motel immediately. And although he tried to question him about what was happening, his manager simply stated, "It's very bad." So Doug drove down to the inn, and as he pulled in, he saw two ambulances parked outside the motel room and noticed that neither of them had their emergency lights on, and that could only mean one thing.
Somebody's dead.
Whoever the victims were, they were both dead. So, and can you imagine that? Like, you hear a body is found at the place where your significant other works, and you try calling them, they're not answering. And then your manager actually tells you to get down there because it's really bad. Just to think the whole way there, you're like, well, also, what does bad mean? Does it mean she is dead, or does it mean she's just hurt or she's missing? Like, that's a very vague thing to tell someone whose wife is murdered.
I would say, you know, if I heard it's very bad, I would think dead. Just because if anything other than that, they would probably say something. They're really hurt, but they're alive. Or they were involved, but they're okay. You know, so when they just say vaguely, it's really bad, it's really bad.
Yeah, I understand that. But also, I think part of you, like a part of your brain to like as a defense mechanism is like, well, they just said it's very bad. They didn't say she's dead. So maybe there's a slim chance that they are okay. And so I think that's just the human brain trying to make sense of such a horrible tragedy.
And that's what his manager was doing, was basically, I'm not going to tell you she's dead so that you can make it there. Otherwise, you'll probably break down and never be able to drive yourself there.
Yeah, that's true. So I guess I get where his manager was coming from. So Doug was given the heartbreaking news that along with Troy Valentine, his wife Melissa was the other victim found inside of the room, and it was a horrific murder scene. Inside room one, investigators found Troy Valentine lying on his back in the middle of the floor in a large pool of blood that almost completely covered the entire floor and soaked into the carpet. His face was bruised and bloody, he had a pair of handcuffs attached to his left wrist, and his flashlight was lying beside him stained with blood. A few feet away, Melissa was found sitting up on the floor with her back against a wall and her head slumped over the side of one of the beds, and she too sat in a pool of blood. A medical examiner named Dr. Cleland Blake arrived at the scene to assess the victims and what he would later describe it to be the most savage crime scene he had ever seen. Immediately, he took notice that Melissa had massive blood stains around her neck and her sweater was soaked with blood. He discovered that she had been shot at close range in the top left side of her head with a small caliber bullet. However, that wasn't what killed her. So the bullet wound had actually been inflicted after she had already been stabbed 18 times in the neck and the chest. Dr. Blake was able to determine that the killing blow was from having her throat slashed deeply, severing her trachea and every major artery in her neck, as well as chipping pieces off of her spinal column. So this was deep, almost nearly decapitated her. But on top of that, Melissa had also suffered fatal stab wounds to both her heart and her lungs and had three separate stab wounds that appeared to have been caused by her killer sticking the knife in and then twisting and ripping it back and forth. So torture. So this was torture. They stuck it in slowly and then just started digging around with it inside of her. So they wanted her to suffer. She had defensive wounds on her hands, including a deep gash across her right palm, which suggested that she tried to fight back against her attacker or attackers. Bruising was visible around her left wrist, which suggested she had been bound with something at some point, most likely handcuffs. Troy Valentine's autopsy revealed that he had suffered a bullet wound directly between his eyes from the same type of bullet that was used to shoot Melissa. Troy suffered several deep stab wounds and slashes to his neck, back, and the back of his head. He had a large laceration across the top of his forehead, which was so brutal it actually left an indention in his skull. The indention matched perfectly with Troy's flashlight, which led Dr. Blake to deduce that he had been beaten over the head with his own flashlight, and most likely rendered unconscious. Dr. Blake was unable to determine which wound actually killed Troy, as on top of having been shot between the eyes, he suffered a stab wound to his throat that was so deep and brutal that it actually broke his jawbone from the sheer force he was stabbed with. It was determined that both had been killed with the same knife. So this was a brutal, horrific crime scene. This wasn't a simple, like, robbery gone wrong, like, shoot them, move on, or just stab them and move on. This was like, they were beaten with flashlights. Poor Melissa had a knife twisted in her at least 3 times. So this was sadistic. So like I said, this was obviously a very sadistic murder scene, the likes of which Gatlinburg had never seen before. And police were baffled because they could find no possible motive as to why. Neither Melissa nor Troy were known to have any enemies, and both were described as being very friendly and warm to people, with Troy actually leaving behind a wife and kid. Now, one possible motive did arise when it was discovered that $499 was missing from the cash register, which today would be about $1,300, and Melissa's purse was also found to be missing. So, robbery was definitely at least part of the motive, but it still didn't explain to police why the two had to be killed and in such a brutal fashion. And so the hunt was on to find their killers. And that's the other thing too, is like, even if it was a robbery, it doesn't make sense. Like, why weren't they left just in the room handcuffed to the bed? There were handcuffs there. Or why were they killed so horrifically? So for the first few days, police had absolutely no leads as to who the killer or killers were. And that sent the entire town of Gatlinburg into a frenzy as tourists and shop owners alike began to panic that a cold-blooded killer was on the loose. Local hotels and business owners began to bump up security with more armed guards patrolling the perimeters each night, and many locals in the area growing suspicious and weary of the outside tourists, as many believed that it just wasn't possible for a local to do such a horrible crime. So the night of the murders also happened to coincide with the arrival of hundreds of bikers passing through the area on their way to North Carolina, which, fun fact, has one of the biggest Harley-Davidson bike rallies happening every year. So many locals felt that the killer had to be one of these tatted, burly biker dudes, and tensions were high between the locals and the bikers, as well as tensions between the locals and investigators, as many in the area were angry that investigators had yet to arrest anyone or investigate the scary bikers. Except the main detective assigned to the case wasn't so sure that it was some scary tatted biker that was involved in the case. So Detective Bud Parton, no relation to Dolly Parton, had grown up and lived in the Gatlinburg area his entire life, and from the time he graduated high school, he joined the police force and over the years developed a reputation for being the quote-unquote the eyes and ears of Gatlinburg. Bud had never seen such a horrific crime before in his nearly 40-year career up to that point, and he was determined to find out who did it. He had help along the way, as the crime was so heinous that the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation actually came in and assisted with the search. Now, although they still had no leads in the murder case, a seemingly unrelated incident did attract the attention of Detective Bud. So, 2 days after the murders, police received a call about a stolen car parked at the Chamber of Commerce, and upon arriving at the scene, they found the stolen car and the 2 people who were in it. The occupants were discovered to be Joe DeModica and his girlfriend, a 26-year-old trans woman named Ashley Silvers. The 2 were taken to Sevier County Jail and questioned about the stolen car, of course denying that they knew anything about it being stolen, and they feigned ignorance. But while they were being interrogated about the stolen car, Detective Bud watched them, and for some unknown reason, he felt in his gut that these 2 knew something about the recent murders at the Rocky Top Inn. However, of course, with no physical evidence to tie them to the murders, both were released and free to go. Now, it would be the next day when the note and the pocket knife were discovered in a phone booth miles away in Maggie Valley, North Carolina. The knife had belonged to Melissa and given to her by her husband, Doug, and the note contained details only the killer would have known. And of course, the note pointed at a man named Joe as being the one who killed the 2, which Detective Bud surmised was none other than Joe DeModica. However, before they could question him, he was already long gone. With all hopes seemed lost for a brief moment, Bud was not about to give up, and it wouldn't take long before the break he needed would show itself. So just days after finding the note at Maggie Valley, Bud received a phone call from one of his informants. So over his 40-year career, Bud was smart and used his skills to amass a huge network of criminal informants all over Gatlinburg, Sevierville, and the Knoxville area. He received a call one day from one of his informants named Tim Farmer, who lived in Knoxville, and stated that he had information related to the murders. Tim went on to state that the night before the murders, a good friend of his named Joe DeMotica and his girlfriend Ashley Silvers had spent the night along with another couple that Tim didn't know that well, but knew their names were Eddie Harris and Kimberly Paley. Tim stated that the foursome had spent the night and by morning had left, telling him that they were planning to go spend the weekend up in Gatlinburg, but not before robbing him blind. So that's why he felt compelled to come forward. Maybe don't bite the hand that feeds you. Tim went on to explain that while at his apartment, he saw Eddie walking around with a leather holster around his waist that contained a large hunting knife with a serrated edge, and that he bragged about keeping a gun in the glove compartment of his Toyota parked outside. Tim also saw a pair of handcuffs hanging from the rearview mirror of the Toyota, and Eddie later told him that he and a friend liked to get people high, drive them out to the woods, handcuff them to a tree, and then do quote-unquote obscene things to them. Tim went on to say that although he didn't know exactly where they lived, he knew that all four were living in Atlanta at the time and had come up to Knoxville to find work. So Bud thought this was a very solid lead and was eager to pursue it, but found himself alone on this front because the TBI was more interested in going to North Carolina to investigate several bikers that had passed through the area. They felt one criminal's confession was not enough evidence to go chasing after people in Atlanta, and they left Bud to do what he wanted while they continued their investigation elsewhere.
Even though the letter had information only the killer would know.
So I think what they were thinking is because the letter was found in North Carolina and the bikers were passing through Gatlinburg to get to North Carolina, I think the thing was like the killer is making his way to North Carolina, so we're going to stick to this area and investigate that part. And Bud tried to tell them, it's like, we found this random stranger, this tourist named Joe, stole a car, and then 2 days after the murder, and then the day after the murder, we find a letter that says a man named Joe did this. So Bud was like, it seems too much of a coincidence for me, but the TBI was just kind of like, if you believe that, good luck, you're on your own. So still going with his gut, Bud began making calls to the Atlanta Police Department searching for clues. He began chasing after all four names given to him by Tim, but found that all of them were very hard to get a hold of, never staying in one place for too long, and mostly living out of motel rooms. And for over a year, he chased down lead after lead, searching for their location. Finally, his big break came in December 1987 when Ashley Silvers was picked up in a rundown motel, and the following week, Joe DeMotica was arrested and held at the county jail on an unrelated charge. So investigators were then able to get into contact with Kimberly Paley's mother, who was able to convince her daughter to turn herself in to police. Now with all three suspects now in custody, that left only Tattoo Eddie Harris on the run, which was his nickname, Tattoo Eddie. Eddie managed to avoid police for several weeks before they finally tracked him down to an apartment he was staying at on December 16, 1987, and arrested him as he was walking across the street to a local diner. Now with all four suspects in custody, all of them were transported back to Gatlinburg to be officially questioned in connection with the murders. So back in Tennessee, all four at first denied having anything to do with the murders, and Eddie himself denied even being in Gatlinburg during the time, and denied having ever traveled with Joe to Knoxville or stay at Tim Farmer's house. He did suggest that if anyone had murdered the two at the inn, it was Joe and Ashley. However, it did not take long before all four began to turn on one another in hopes of escaping prosecution. Always happens, tale as old as time. And within days of being questioned, all four were arrested and charged with first-degree murder. So, Eddie Harris was the first to stand trial, which began on May 9, 1988, and prosecution made it clear that they were seeking the death penalty due to the brutal nature of the crime. So Eddie Tattoo Harris was a 32-year-old convicted felon who was already very well known to police. He got his nickname Tattoo Eddie because he had over 136 tattoos all over his body, which included several teardrops under his right eye. He was born in Baltimore, Maryland, but grew up in Asheville, North Carolina. Having grown up in a very abusive household, Eddie dropped out of school in the third grade and left home at 14, and he was almost completely illiterate and could not write without the assistance of another person. He survived by hustling on the streets and breaking into homes to steal stuff and then pawn it off for money. But, of course, as he grew older, Eddie also started to develop a mean and sadistic streak that eventually got him arrested at just 18 years old and charged with rape, armed robbery, and sodomy. He was sentenced to 10 to 15 years in prison at a Georgia correctional facility, and it was here that he would meet and befriend Joe DeMonica, who was in there for armed robbery. So the two kept in contact after being released from prison, and they agreed to meet back up at some point. Now, following his release from prison, Eddie briefly married and had two kids before getting divorced and then moving to Atlanta, Georgia, where he survived by working as a go-go dancer at several gay bars in the area and working as a gay hustler for a time in order to support himself. Now, from several reports I could find, he made conflicting statements sometimes about telling people he was bisexual and then telling other people he wasn't bisexual. So it's one of those cases where more than likely he was bisexual, but he didn't want to admit it. But again,
it was the 80s.
It was the 80s. So it makes sense why you wouldn't want that to be public knowledge.
Even though you murdered somebody.
Yeah, it's better to be known as a murderer than that you like dudes. So Joe DeMonica actually agreed to be the prosecution's star witness at the trial because the prosecution and everyone was convinced that Eddie Harris is the ringleader. Everyone else was afraid of him. He was a big burly dude. He was a scary looking dude. So kind of, I can see where they got that assumption. So Joe decided to tell them everything and walk the court through everything that happened in the days leading up to and after the murders. So according to Joe, in August of 1986, he and Ashley were on a trip down to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, when by pure happenstance, they happened to bump into Eddie at a gay bar, and the three started talking and hanging out for a few days. After this, Eddie joined the two as they drove up to Daytona and partied for a few more days before making their way to Atlanta. It was here that Eddie had them stop and pick up one of his girlfriends at the time, Kimberly Paley. The foursome decided from here that they were going to drive up to Knoxville, Tennessee, as Joe believed that he and Eddie could get jobs working as male strippers at a bar called the Pepper Tree. Now, I also found reports that stated the bar was called the Lemon Tree, so I'm honestly not sure which is correct because whichever it was, it no longer exists. I've only lived in Knoxville for about 10 years now. Have you heard of the Pepper or the Lemon Tree?
I would have been shocked that there was a place in Knoxville that had male strippers.
Well, you would be shocked because there was actually a place that had male strippers. So whichever it is, if you are in the Knoxville area or you're very familiar with Knoxville lore, please reach out to us because I am very curious to know about this bar with male strippers. So Joe had worked here as a stripper once before, and he knew it was an easy gig to make some quick money to continue their partying. So they made their way up to Knoxville, and the Sunday before the murders, Eddie and Joe stripped at the club in order to get enough money for a hotel room for the night. And also, if you look at these men, Joe DeMonica did not look like the type of person you'd want to throw ones at on a stage while he took his clothes off. Eddie was okay looking, but again, scary dude covered in head to toe from tattoos, which is not a bad thing, the tattoos themselves, but even just looking at photos of him, you can tell he has a very mean and uncomfortable aura about him. So by Monday, both men were broke and they wouldn't be able to strip again until the following Friday. So now they were stuck in Knoxville without any money. They stopped at a friend's house, a lesbian couple named Tracy and Connie Clark, and they used their driveway to park their car so they could all sleep inside of it. The next morning, Eddie and Joe robbed the couple's elderly neighbors and stole several $100s of jewelry and clothes, which of course they pawned off to get more money. They got money to survive for the rest of the week by going and donating plasma at various blood centers in the area, which, why couldn't you do that full-time instead of robbing elderly people? So by Friday, they were once again out of money, and they found out that they wouldn't be able to strip at the club that night. So that's when they went to the apartment of Tim Farmer and spent the night. It was here that Eddie began to brag to Tim about how he had once murdered his cellmate while in prison and gotten away with it since the guards thought it was an accident. The foursome tried to get Tim to join them on a trip to Gatlinburg, but he refused and left for work the next morning. By the time he got home, all four were gone, and so were various items that belonged to him, which of course the group had stolen to pawn off and get money. The group spent the day of September 13th riding around and checking out all the various sites and attractions that Gatlinburg had to offer, which included hiking up to Laurel Falls and hanging out there for the day. By evening, the group decided to get a motel room for the night, but Eddie and Joe suggested they drive around for a while and look for potential places to rob in order to get some money. The foursome eventually settled on staying at the Rocky Top Village Inn, and while Joe and Ashley waited in the car, Kimberly went inside to the back office to rent a room while Eddie stood outside. A few minutes later, Kimberly emerged from the office with Melissa Hill, who led her and Eddie to room 1 located directly behind the office. After unlocking the door, the trio returned to the office where Kimberly and Eddie followed Melissa behind the counter and then held a knife to her throat and ordered her to open the cash register. After she did what they asked, they stole the money and then led Melissa back to the motel room where Joe stated he heard, quote-unquote, a little bit of a commotion coming from inside but wasn't sure what was actually going on. Now, while this was going on, Joe was busy parking the car away from the motel room to make it look less suspicious, and a few minutes after doing this is when Troy Valentine arrived and began looking for Melissa. As Troy approached room 1, he heard several screams coming from inside before Eddie emerged from the room and attacked Troy. As he held Troy down on the pavement, Kimberly emerged from the room and used Troy's own flashlight to beat him over the head with it until he was unconscious. The two dragged Troy back inside the motel room and shut the door, and from there was some commotion and screaming before Joe heard Eddie shout, "If you don't do what I tell you, you're going to end up like them," before he heard 2 gunshots. Now, after a few more minutes, Eddie and Kimberly emerged from the room, both covered from head to toe in blood and carrying Melissa's purse and a wad of cash. The foursome piled back into the car, drove back to Knoxville, where they again slept in the car parked in the Clark's driveway. And the next morning they woke up, drove to a laundromat where Kimberly and Eddie washed their clothes before borrowing a friend's car, and that's when the group went their separate ways. Eddie and Kimberly drove to Nashville, and Joe and Ashley drove back to Gatlinburg, which is where they would eventually be arrested for the first time driving a stolen vehicle.
So this was a brazen attack because parts of it actually happened out in a parking lot. And I'm telling you, 1980-something Gatlinburg's probably just as popping as Gatlinburg is right now. There's people around everywhere, and I would say there was a lot of people at that motel that night. So to attack somebody right out in the parking lot, that is brazen.
But also, I think that just shows this group dynamic. Like, one, they weren't the brightest to begin with. Like I said, Eddie dropped out of school in 3rd grade. But at the same time, you could just tell by how nonchalant and go with the flow they are. It's like, we need money. Let's just drive up to Gatlinburg, spend all the money we have, and then when we need more, we'll just find a place to rob.
Yeah, after they've robbed multiple places just that week to get up to Gatlinburg.
And that's the thing, is like, do first and then ask questions later. So I don't think any of them were thinking like, oh, who cares if it's right out in the open and there are 100 witnesses. The problem right now is we need to get rid of this one person that saw what was going on in this room. And like I said, there is about one neuron firing between all these people, and it's not a very bright one. So Joe ended his statement by saying that the reason he did not come forward sooner was because Eddie had put a gun to his head and told him that if he said a word about what happened, then he would kill him. So now, this story matched up pretty good and was corroborated by several other witnesses called to testify, which included Tim Farmer, Tim's neighbor who stated he saw the 4 at the apartment the day before the murders, and Ashley Silvers, who stated that Joe was indeed in the car with her during the murders and that he never left.
Then why did she say Joe killed the people in the letter?
Well, I was about to say, who do you think wrote the letter?
Ashley.
Okay, you think Ashley wrote the letter. Okay. So one of them did write the letter, and it may not be who you think it is. So a broken fingernail was also found inside of the motel room that was a match for belonging to Kimberly Pele. However, Eddie's defense countered this by stating that while they weren't denying Eddie was present, they argued Joe was downplaying his own role in the murders and was saying anything to avoid the death penalty. He was also a known violent criminal and obviously was not the most trustworthy witness. Eddie would also state that it was Joe who actually carried around a gun and a pair of handcuffs and that he was the mastermind behind the whole thing. A handwriting expert and Eddie's mother and ex-wife were also called in to the stand, and they testified and confirmed that the note found in the phone booth in Maggie Valley was in fact written by Eddie Harris.
Well, that's a surprise. I just assumed it was Ashley.
Nope. It was Eddie. The handwriting expert confirmed it. His wife, his mother confirmed it. And he was, like I said, he couldn't write very well without the help of assistance from someone else. However, if you look at the actual letter, it is full of abbreviations and misspelled words, like very simple words. So it does actually line up that Eddie was the one who wrote it. And remember, in it, he stated he was afraid of Joe. And that also kind of leads some credence because, like, he wrote the letter before police ever knew him or Joe were ever involved. So, obviously, at this point, people were like, I think there's more to the story. So, in Eddie's version of events, it pretty much plays out exactly the same until the actual murder part. Kimberly did lead Melissa into the motel room, but then Joe and Eddie both followed in after them. Eddie thought the plan was simply to handcuff Melissa to the bed while they robbed the place and then leave her there while they escaped. The plan was going smoothly and Melissa was cooperating until Troy pulled up and heard the commotion inside. He used a spare key to get into the room, and that's when Joe forced him to the ground and put a handcuff on him and attempted to handcuff him to the bed as well. Again, things seemed to be under control again until Joe saw Troy attempting to reach for the gun lying on the bed. At that point, Joe became enraged and went berserk, beating Troy over the head with a flashlight before violently stabbing both him and Melissa before ordering Eddie to shoot both of them or else he would kill him too. Joe threatened to murder Eddie if he didn't keep quiet, and it was on his way back home that Eddie, so riddled with guilt that he wrote out the note and left it and the knife in a phone booth in hopes to ease his conscience. So this is kind of like the Rashomon effect. I don't know if any listeners have watched Rashomon, but it's the same singular event from various different point of views, and all of them have certain elements in common, but there's certain big drastic changes to it. So this is pretty drastic. I mean, either one of them did, one of them saying the other one was the mastermind, the other one was saying the other one was a mastermind. But in any case, in the end, it was up to the jury to decide who to believe. And on May 14th, 1988, they returned with a verdict for Eddie Harris. They found him guilty on all charges of first-degree murder and sentenced to death in both cases. The next day's headline all over Gatlinburg newspapers simply stated dead across the entire front page. So the town of Gatlinburg rejoiced and celebrated at the news, but there were still three other co-conspirators whose fates had to be decided. So, next up on the chopping block was Ashley Silvers, who was charged and found guilty of accessory after the fact and received a 20-year sentence. Kimberly was the next one to go to trial, and at her, she attempted to argue that she was nothing more than an accessory after the fact as well, stating that Eddie was a very violent and abusive boyfriend towards her and would often beat her. She stated that he threatened to kill her if she didn't keep her mouth shut and that she was terrified of him and that she just did whatever he wanted. The jury, however, wasn't buying it, and neither was the judge, who stated that he firmly believed that she was no mere passive participant in the murders and that she played a very active role in the killings. She would be found guilty of first-degree murder and given two life sentences with the possibility of parole. Now, the final one was Joe DeMotica. And by this point, the news and media circus around these four criminals had grown massive. It was the front page story on every paper in the tri-state area and was covered by every major news station. The case, of course, was sensationalized, as they always are, with people focusing on the fact that two of the men in the group worked as gay strippers and that one was in a relationship with a trans woman. And of course, this is East Tennessee in the 1980s. So of course, the details were blown way out of proportion and harped on by the media, who painted the four as being quote-unquote attractions straight out of Ripley's Believe It or Not. So their gender and sexual identities, combined with the horrific nature of their crimes, really caused the story to take off and become the talk of the town. Thousands gathered outside of the courtroom as everyone wanted to get in and see the final trial and the fate of Joe DeMotica. But now his trial was about to get a big twist, as one of the star witnesses for the prosecution was none other than Ashley Silvers. But unlike Eddie's trial, where she took the stand to defend Joe, she was taking the stand in Joe's trial to implicate him further in the murders. Ashley stated that it was Joe who was the ringleader that night, and he was the one who told the group that they were going to the Rocky Top Inn to rob the place and quote-unquote leave no witnesses. She went on to back up Eddie's version of events with Joe being present in the room during the murders while she waited in the car. Now, upon hearing Ashley's testimony, Joe began shouting and screaming at her, calling her a liar, and stating that he was going to kill her, before literally jumping from his seat and charging through the courtroom at her before being tackled to the ground by two guards. So yeah, that does not look good when you're already on trial for another murder, and now you literally scream, "I'm going to kill you," and you charge at someone to attack them. Doesn't look really good.
I think he already knew the writing on the wall.
He's like, if I'm going to go down, I might as well try it. So in the end, Joe DeMonica would be found guilty of first-degree murder, and he was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, plus an additional 40 years. So, however, even with everyone involved with the murders being sentenced, there were still unanswered questions. To this date, nobody is sure for exact... To this date, nobody is for sure exactly who was the one who actually murdered Melissa and Troy. Eddie, Kimberly, and Joe all point the finger at the other one as being solely responsible. Ashley maintains that she does in fact know for certain who killed who. However, she refuses to say any more than that as she does not want to be labeled a snitch in prison. Even after they were convicted, Detective Bud Parton continued to visit Eddie and Joe in prison, hoping to get one of them to confess the full truth to him. But sadly, he would pass away from heart failure at the age of 66 before they revealed any more information. His last words to Eddie being, "Eddie, you may be on death row, but you're still going to outlive me." Ashley Silvers was paroled in 2005 and now lives a quiet life away from the public eye. Joe DeMonica died in prison in 2006 from complications due to AIDS. Kimberly Pele was paroled in 2011 and is currently living in the Nashville area. Eddie Harris sat on death row for almost 20 years until 2002 when a court deemed him to have a mental disability, and this caused his death sentence to be commuted to life in prison. However, on March 10, 2015, Eddie Harris was attacked by his cellmate at the Morgan County Correctional Facility in Wartburg, Tennessee. 36-year-old Greg Smith, who was already serving a life sentence for a murder in 2005, surprised attacked Eddie and stabbed him repeatedly in the neck and chest with a homemade shank, and Eddie was pronounced dead at 8:30 a.m. And if you remember, Melissa and Troy were also stabbed repeatedly in the neck and the chest, so is that the universe delivering karma? I don't know. Now, the Rocky Top Village Inn Motel remained in operation for quite a while after the murders, but of course it was never able to escape its violent past. Over the years, rumors began swirling amongst locals that the hotel was haunted and that oftentimes screams could be heard echoing throughout the whole building. Guests reported hearing the sounds of disembodied voices and crying and the sound of gunshots late at night. This, of course, led to a whole slew of true crime and paranormal enthusiasts visiting who just made the Rocky Top Inn another attraction to see and experience when visiting Gatlinburg. The motel was torn down in 2003, and a Courtyard Marriott now sits in its place. But although the building may be gone, the memories of what happened there live on with the locals and probably will for years to come. And that is the story of the Gatlinburg Motel murders. It's one interesting one that I came across that I didn't really know about. And it's just one of those, again, one of those senseless crimes. Like, this didn't have to happen. Even if you were going to rob them, that's the thing, is like, I'm sure they were like, "I do not care if you rob this whole place blind. Like, I value my life more than this job. Just handcuff me to the bed and leave me be." But that just shows you what monsters all four of these people were.
Yeah, the guy they beat to death first, or I mean, beat him with the flashlight and then killed him first, was already handcuffed to the bed. So he went for the gun. All you had to do was pull it away. It's not like he's going anywhere. He's still subdued at that point.
And then the girl, poor 21-year-old Melissa, like, during both accounts, both of them did cooperate. Like, Melissa was being very cooperative with them. She wasn't trying to do anything. She was just like, take the money and leave. And that's the sad thing, too, is like just the fact that it's, again, it's just so senseless. These kind of crimes, I can't wrap my head around because it is so senseless.
It's just a waste of life.
And it's just a waste of life. Like, you ruined, you took two innocent people's lives away from their families. You threw your own lives away. I mean, it wasn't much to look at before, but you could have been living it up as male strippers in Knoxville at the Pepper Tree. And instead, you chose to be shitbag human beings and murder two innocent people. And you kind of got what was coming to you. So, and with that, thank you guys again so much for tuning in for another episode. If you enjoyed this episode and the podcast, please leave us a 5-star review on Amazon or iTunes. Helps us out a lot, helps other people discover the podcast, and we just love hearing your guys' feedback. If you want to see photos from this case, you can follow us on Instagram at Beers with Queers Pod, that's P-O-D, or on Facebook at Beers with Queers, a true crime podcast. And until Monday, stay dangerous out there, my friend.
See you soon.
Bye.